Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Monday edition of The Daily Friend. I'm Nicholas Lorimer, back in the host chair, and I'm joined today with two of my most esteemed colleagues, Sara Gon, the editor-in-chief of The Daily Friend. Sara, how are you today?
Oh, no, I'm well.
And Mr. Gabriel Krauser, my co-podcaster in crime.
Yeah. And other things.
And other things, yes. So today, let's get stuck in with a bit of happy news, which is that our former colleague, Gwen Nguyenya, has returned to head of the policy of the DA. Gabriel, you said this, you had particular feelings about this.
I said, freedom now has a chance to ring again. I think those are my words.
Wow.
Look, that she's does powerful. Sound like, well, I think she's serious. Mm. And I think that it's a sign that the DA is gearing up to be serious. We look forward to the policy conference in the DA, which will precede the proper sort of gathering.
Federal Congress.
The Federal Congress, where they elect their leaders in a longer-term basis. Currently, John Steenhuisen is the interim leader of the party, and that'll be an opportunity for him to get a proper mandate or to be defeated, as the case may be. But I think that that election coming after the policy discussion is very important because I have a lot of time for John Steenhuisen. And I think that he's really been very charismatic in Parliament. But as good as he is, I'm more interested in policy than I am in any particular personality. And that's something that Gwen wants to focus on. That's something that she did focus on before. And I think that bringing her back is a sign that there will be at least some kind of debate. So to give some context to why I think so, we will all have heard of the black exodus that took place when two black leaders left the DA a month ago or so. But at the start of the year, there was a half black exodus, I guess, when Gwen Nguyenya left. And yet it was not named so.
Thusly.
And I think that's partly for the very good reason that Nguyenya doesn't buy into that way of thinking about things. And so it's harder to stick that label onto her in some kind of meaningful way. But I do also think that it's partly because she irks some of our big media hitters.
I think irk is a very gentle way of putting it.
Yeah, and I think she's keen to make people think, and that is an irritating process, especially when people are sort of cushioned in soft, flabby, lazy ideas. Mm-hmm. Milton Friedman had this nice thing of like, sometimes what you really do is you take a needle if someone's sitting on a balloon cushion and you deflate it or you pop it and then they find themselves sitting hard on the bones of their bum. And then they're not super happy, but they get a chance to stand up and walk around and really take it in the environment. I think that's the kind of thing that she's into. As a clue for her still not being particularly well-liked, one of the major daily papers that takes itself quite seriously announced this by saying that the federal executive has rubber-stamped the return of Gwen Nguyenya.
That was Business Day, I think.
Well, I was trying to avoid saying which in particular it was.
You avoided. I'm not going to.
Which is just crazy. I mean, it was quite an arduous process. The federal executive doesn't rubber stamp anything. There's clearly, I mean, they're trying to be sweet and nice about each other in public, but there clearly have been serious ructions in the party.
They continue to be serious.
And there continue to be very serious ructions in the party, which is why the policy conference coming up, no one is going to tell you now what the conclusion of that policy conference is going to be. It could be something, it could be anything, actually, at this stage. And if anyone wants to tell you for sure who's going to be the DA leader after the conference, then I think they're overestimating their epistemic capacity.
Yeah.
So rubber stamping is just not something that's happening right now. It's really just a way of kind of trying to make this into a mum moment, like a who cares moment. Much like when she resigned in fury because she said words to the effect that the party's not taking policy seriously, that even to bring up BEE as a topic of contention and maybe something that needs to be discussed instead of just followed through in this ANC light way, created a hostile environment. She said, people attacked me. The leader wasn't stepping up to try and defend her or try to defend the sort of rules of robust, reason-based, evidence-based debate. Shortly after she left, there was this conference famously where Musi Maimane said, shut up, to people who wanted to talk about BEE. And those really mattered to me as a potential voter. I took that very seriously. And a lot of the people that I spoke to doing the rounds, journalism on the beat in the rural parts of this country, in the urban parts of this country, you know, that is the kind of thing that freaked a lot of people out about the DA. And it just wasn't given, it was given like a moment and then, but, you know, just played down as being not that important. There are other things to focus on. Anyway, I want to say that partly I think Ngwenya gets a rough ride from the media and they try to lay her down because she doesn't fit into their ideology. But partly it's just because she's so good at writing. I just want to read.
Nobody hates a good writer more than another writer.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I just want to read one paragraph from a piece that she wrote earlier this year for Politics Web, our competition and also a wonderful publication that
yes.
I strongly encourage everyone to read now and then. And it is called ESCOM and BEE, A Total Eclipse of the Brain. And the basic contention is that, you know, some people want to say that there's no connection between BEE and ESCOM. And in fact, Gwen's, what I, from the outside, as someone who doesn't really know these players, have taken to be her arch rival, Phumzile van Dam, really epitomizes a different way of thinking. It's a way of thinking that is sort of not about really jabbing people's ideas, but about punching people in the face.
So to speak.
Well, not quite literally, had said, you know, if you think that there's any connection between BEE and ESCOM, then you must be a racist. And Gwen is sort of writing, I'm not sure if it was before or after, but writing into that same contention with a different point of view. And so just a paragraph from the piece, which is taken a bit out of context, but I hope that the point is listen to the writing. Why is ESCOM in trouble? Because it has high operating costs and it cannot meet its debt obligations. Why? Its ambitious program to build two big power stations has incurred substantial cost overruns and technical faults. Why? In part, it was flawed from the beginning with a small bidding pool, meaning it was likely not to cost competitive from the start. Why? There was political meddling. Why? Chancellor House. Why? Contractors needed to have a black partner in order to secure contracts. Why? BEE. And in that paragraph, you have what the philosopher calls an etiology.
Yes.
A series of causal chains, which when linked together, create...
And draw you back to the original...
The shackles that weigh this country down. Mm-hmm. And Chancellor House, one thing about how laconic it is that those not entirely familiar with how the ANC makes money might not realize that Chancellor House is the investment arm of the ANC itself.
Mm-hmm.
And this crisis of creating policy, which... creates a competitive advantage for not just any old company, but for the company that is the party which in any case couldn't manage to pay its bills. It's just so juicy, it's so true, it's so right, and it really, in quite a few words, gets to the heart of the matter. And I think that's a hard thing for a journalist to look at and not either feel admiration or like that...
Resentment.
That resentment that makes one say, okay, the DA's got a proper policy head, well, meh.
So, you know, I'm. We've seen the story.
Jealousy
before.
Makes you nasty.
when Gwen left the IRR for the DA to become its policy head, I think quite a lot of us in the liberal community were quite pleased by this because we know that, you know, Gwen is serious about ideas and serious about ideology. And then we saw what happened though. She proceeded to be ignored, and when the friction point really came, when she really had a chance to make a difference in the DA turned away from her. So the real question is, she's back, and that's a very good first step, but there's more steps to be taken. How optimistic are you that they will be taken?
It's difficult to say, but I think there's been a change in the general, a lot of the position holders, and I think that helps, certainly towards a more classical liberal approach. Whether that's going to be enough at the policy conference, one doesn't know. But the thing that both annoys the media about Gwen and is her strength is that she's a classical liberal to the core, and she has absolutely no discomfort in dealing with it. In fact, probably to a point where people found her uncomfortable as a result. But one of the advantages of having been in the situation she was under Maimane and then leaving is that she too learned to understand that she had to be, if not diplomatic, a lot more nuanced in presenting things to an environment that was actually very different to where she'd come from, where debate wasn't necessarily as robust as one likes to think it should be.
Yes.
And so she's more attuned to those shenanigans, if I can put it that way, within a political party. But she's her intellect is formidable, and I can't think of too many people anywhere in the country who would, particularly at her tender age, who would be suited to actually being able to tackle the wide range of policy issues that the DA should be getting to grips with.
Now, I think this is if you can think of it as the DA having to do three things to recover its position. One is appoint competent people. Two is let those competent people actually do things. And then three is take the positiveness and the difference between the ANC that has been created by those competent people and then sell it to people. So we seem to be going nicely through stage one. Let's see if we can get to stage two.
Also, we'll come to it, but also if the DA rather takes a more robust position on the whole BE question, the environment's a little rife for that, given the fact that the ANC is not feeling as quite as wedded as a result of the Eskom CEO appointment as it was 3 days ago.
Yes, but we'll get onto that in but a moment.
Well, we were talking about Eskom already.
Yes. by talking about what Eskom is being forced to do. So just before we recorded this podcast, a news story has gone up that Eskom is thinking about cutting off power to three municipalities, the biggest of which is the municipality that contains Bloemfontein, Mangaung. According to the news story on News 24, Eskom has said to the municipality, if they don't receive payment for money owed by the municipality for the supply of electricity by the 3rd of December, they will not supply the municipality power between the hours of 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock.
That's 6 a.m. and 8 p.m.
So basically nothing in the daylight, which is going to be quite brutal if it actually goes ahead. And a lot of municipalities, especially in the poorer parts of the country, especially in Free State, seem to have a very bad track record of paying Eskom for money owed, but there's now been the appointment of a new CEO. Sara, what are your thoughts on this appointment?
Well, we've talked about the CEO Andrea de Reiter to some extent last week, but what's really interesting, and I'd like to do some quoting if I may, is that the far left NUMSA, and in this case NUMSA in particular, but the other guys fall into line, had the following to say: what we want to categorically and unapologetically state about the appointment of Andre de Reiter by the Eskom board is that such an appointment constitutes nothing less than a setback in the history of the transformation agenda in this country. His appointment constitutes an insult to many competent black executives, in particular black women, and it goes on in that vein. But here's the kicker, is apparently
Why is it particularly to black women? I mean, is it Andre de Reiter is definitely a handsome guy. Is some kind of point trying to be made about, is he going to distract the ladies?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Irvin Jim.
Yes. But the real funny, the ironic thing is that according to the agency that had to interview and shortlist people, they approached 27 top black executives for the job, all of whom declined. And they all declined.
I do not blame them.
But this is what they said. They felt there's too – doesn't this sound familiar? There's too much political interference. And one insider said, and I quote, SOEs have ruined a lot of careers and reputations. It's where careers go to die. And a lot of black executives are saying no to them. Eskom, as the apex SOE, is even worse. They won't touch it. So in other words, all that whole thing about a white guy being appointed to Eskom and how it's blown transformation ANC style, it's just all complete and utter nonsense. I mean, the transformation idea is rubbish anyway, but it just goes to show that Irvin Jim has said this, and the response has been, yeah, but all the good black guys didn't want it because it's a disaster.
It's a disaster. It is a disaster. I want to chip in. I know that this appointment was discussed last week, and I have no reason to doubt that de Reiter is an upstanding gentleman, someone who has the best interests of the country and the utility at his heart, and that he has shown that he has the ability to retrench workers, which I think is a key issue relating to Eskom, and so he's proven that he can do that at NAMPAC. I still think that it's worth connecting this idea that the 27 you've mentioned now, executives that turned down the job, did so because they worried about state interference. One of the key points that was reported on various from various other news publications last week was that the person that most people thought was going to get the job, Andy Karlitz or Andries Karlitz, had come forward with a plan. Whereas De Reiter was sort of like, well, if you like me, then we can make the plan up together. Which is sort of seems like a starting point of making room for that political interference. I do hope that everyone knows that LNG Canada, the mission that Karlitz is running, is that $50 billion enterprise. I mean, it really is bigger than Eskom. It's not bigger than Eskom's total assets under valuation, but with Eskom's liabilities built into it, it's like a bigger operation than Eskom. And it's probably the most prestigious in the world in the oil and energy and gas industry, because precisely what it required was a co-investment from South Koreans and Japanese companies that are suspicious of each other because they're on the cutting edge of technology and they don't necessarily want to – they worry about getting in bed together and technologies being pilfered. The Canadians and – Shell with its UK and Dutch and Europeans and Russian kind of connections, getting along with those guys, and on top of that, the Chinese and then the Canadian authorities, and to get Canadian authorities and Chinese gas experts and sort of state-owned company to agree on how to go about things requires someone who's got two particular skills. One is to cross social and cultural divides in an environment of mutual mistrust and to find a way to manage that. And of course, the second side is to not manage it in the following way. Here's an easy way to manage it. You go hang out with these, with the Chinese, and you say, oh, those Canadians, they're such tree huggers. They're so flippin' obsessed with green. They're so overly regulated. They're not practical. Then you go out with the Canadians and you're like, oh, those Chinese, they're so brutal. They don't really care for their workers. And by becoming a chameleon that takes on the political ideology of whatever's dominating in the room, you make everyone happy because you're all things to all comers, but you don't really balance the forces in a way that produces a positive outcome. What you end up doing is getting a lot of short-winded wins for no long-term outcome that's worth anything. And when this project was being cooked up, the world needed to find a leader, a business leader who could manage that process of getting people from very different sides of the aisle, so to speak, to come together and work together in a value-add way. And they found Karlitz, and he could do that. And one of the things, if he'd come here to do this job, is it would have been, the world's eyes would have been at his back. It would have been noticed. It would have been extremely difficult to bully him. I'm not saying impossible, and he might have been driven out of his job and back to that, although he probably wouldn't get that job back, and it would be in a sort of great sort of case of patriotic sacrifice in order to get something right. And it's just worth noting the difference in stature between Karlitz and De Reuter, that De Reuter is slightly potentially easier to bully, and what Irvin Jim seems to be doing is trying to launch the opening salvos of a larger project of undermining the kind of value add, sustainable economic prospects that we really should be thinking about in regard to Eskom, and just get us thinking about anything else. As long as you're thinking about anything else, it's easier and easier for the unions to then come away with above inflation increases and retaining a bloated staff and so on.
I can't contradict you at all, because I don't have the detail. Just point out what came out on in the weekend papers. And that was that De Reiter, they say, the insiders say.
These are all insiders, so I'm also just reporting on.
Had performed extremely well during the interviews and came up at top of the assessment process.
Yeah.
He'd prepared a presentation that explained his approach to the unbundling process, how to restructure the debt, and to deal with Eskom's bloated employee numbers. Mm. Now, where that...
That's the good thing. I'm very into that.
But now, where that's particularly interesting, just what you said about Irvin Jim, is somewhere at the bottom of Irvin Jim's diatribe is the point that he and De Reiter knocked heads together at NAMPAC, because obviously NUMSA was the key union there. And he, Irvin Jim sees him as a sort of employee slayer of the world, in that he does not shy away from getting rid of employees. And that was one of the things that Irvin Jim is particularly upset about. So that might make him very less susceptible. He knows what he's dealing with.
So I take that point. I'm just complicating it with two things. And one of the – and I think I've said the one. The other is that there is this difference. Numsa and Irvin Jim, I think, probably play out in a different kind of way to NUM or other major unions. NUM is I think, a bigger union represented at Eskom. Mm. And then there's Solidaritate.
Yeah.
And so I think it's probably easy for ANC loyalists who – also are anti-capitalist socialists, and so generally fall on the side of unions and against employers, to think, well, in this case, we can make an exception because, yeah, we have a crazy dude who's trying to run against us, who splintered away from us, who said some nasty things about us. And if we can isolate him and we can put him down, that is one thing. And that's what's happened at SAA, and he's starting to play the same role at Eskom.
No,
but it's not to say that the levers are going to be exactly the same. And one of my worries is the insider reports from last week about who was making the evaluations was that it was Pravin Gordhan, Ibrahim Patel, Gwede Mantashe, and Toho Didiza. And those are not the that's missing a name that I'd like to see for sure, Tito Mboweni, and it's missing a few others.
No, absolutely, and most of the reports just don't give enough detail to quite know who was doing what and when. But I think you're absolutely right on NUM.
Yeah.
It's NUMSA was the big cheese in COSATU and now it's the SAFTU union, and NUMSA, NUM, and Solidarity are the unions that are in the bargaining unit. So Solidarity obviously represents a distinct sector, whereas the other two are in competition. So they might be waiting to see what the rate does to NUMSA members.
Yeah. It is a pattern that every time a non-ANC union stands against the ANC, it often does actually get some resistance. The unions that the ANC is most ready to cave to are COSATU unions because of that political alignment.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think that this does put Irvin at a disadvantage. I would also like to take a cheap shot at Irvin here by reminding everyone that his party, the Socialist Revolutionary Workers' Party, in the last election managed 0.14% of the vote.
I think they had more flyers up than they got votes.
Yeah, they had quite a lot of posters. They were much better funded than some other parties. They were down there just beating out Black First, Land First.
For no seats.
Yes, for no seats.
In the no seat contest, they did beat Land First.
Yeah,
and they haven't been banned.
They did also beat the Purple Cow with its no money and
yeah. and the internet.
Yes.
Well, beating the internet's pretty good.
I think Irvin Jim has perhaps a slightly misplaced idea of how he fits into the hierarchy of South Africa's.
Right. Yeah. So he's an expendable little sideshow.
Yes.
If things turn out that way. I mean, it might be that he's also sort of gets to play the role of the silly clown that kind of functions as a canary in the gold mine, or, you know, kind of idea tester. So he throws these wacky things out. You see, what do the race merchants in the media have to say about it? Are they buying it? Are they resisting it? If he starts getting a few lines to stick, then, you know, okay, the serious guys can start taking that up.
All right, and we're going to move on to the last thing today, which is our wonderful comrade Jesse Duarte from the ANC, who over the weekend had some rather bizarre things to say, if one is familiar with the career of Jesse Duarte. She said that the ANC is a tribalistic and racist party, or at least it has a problem with tribalism and racism. Here is the quote from her. "We have almost become tribalists in the way we present ourselves. We are racist in the ANC because we marginalize people who are not Black African people, keep them out of the ANC at all costs, and put one or two there as tokens so we can say, Maraya, you know that Ujesi here is representing." She went on to say, "We won't accept the fact that non-racialism is a core value of the ANC. We don't want to accept that. We even go as far as creating myths. I don't like the term colored people. I never refer to myself as a colored ever in my life, and I never will." She said, "Some in the ANC say that so-called colored people benefited from apartheid. Then I ask those who say that, have they ever been to Westbury? I doubt. Have they ever been to Rivoli Extension or Nuclear? I would very much doubt that, said Duarte.
Does so she think that colored people only live in those two places?
Well, you know, the ANC people always speak in terms of cliches and
yes.
So like, if you haven't been to Soweto, then you can't have met a black dude.
Yeah. Well, she goes on to then say this whole story about how during the struggle she had gone to Soweto to campaign for the ANC, and that had Soweto activists from the ANC had come to Rivoli to campaign there. So she's trying to make the point that, and I've done a little bit of, back when I was a politician, did a little bit of campaigning in those areas, specifically Westbury, Rivoli, and those things. And there is a real sense among the coloured community there that the ANC is racist. Mm. You hear stories all the time of people, you know, you don't always know if they're true or not, but people will say, you see the housing is being given out on racial preference grounds. Mm. They'll say
that. Bumped up the list or bumped down the list of
ODP. Or they'll say coloured people get the bad houses over there and black people get the houses over there. There's also stories about sort of ANC trucks driving around parts of those areas and shouting racial slurs against coloured people. You know, these things are often difficult to prove, but there is at least a very real sense in those communities that that the ANC doesn't really like minorities.
I think the reality is, especially since the beginning of the Zuma era, that looked like it became practice that sort of the Black African ANC completely or pretty much completely ignored the Black Indian, the Black coloured part of the ANC. And you've heard once heard about these complaints for years, but the issue of racism has tended to be suppressed. And the discussions about racism by the sort of Black African majority on the Indian and coloured minorities. And it sounds like what's happened with Duarte is that she's been confronted with it to enough of an extent to actually be raising the issue herself, which is quite extraordinary, given the fact that she's been Deputy Secretary General of the ANC for a considerable period of time.
So one option is that the temperature's been turned up or it's been sustained for so long that she's finally cracked, and like, as loyal as she is to the party, the personal offense that she's taken is Trump. Well, the other option is the context of these
remarks is that she was giving a memorial lecture to an ANC branch in Soweto.
And was not getting well received.
Well, the story does not relate.
Yeah. I mean, the other possibility is that she's starting to find herself being a little bit left out in the cold.
Yes. Mm.
She was on the NDZ.
Probably for the same reason.
She was on the NDZ side of the... No, but I'm saying there might be other reasons. She was basically campaigning against Cyril Ramaphosa in the build-up to NASREC 2017, as much as anybody could be said to do so. And then there was sort of when Mabuza flipped at the last minute, there was some question about what her status would be. Is she, you know, good, has she got the acumen to have not jabbed the knife in so hard that you can't sort of flip over to the other side as well? And in any event, there were questions about, you know, how much of the NEC ends up being Ramaphosa's people, how much of it ends up being Zuma's people. Anyways, if it's the case that the ANC internal sort of whatever criminology you want to, it's quite a shrouded set of corridors and warrens behind which those power plays happen. But if she's being isolated and no longer has the kind of patronage network pull that she's had before, and no longer has the kind of prospects going forward that she had before, that might also be something that explains this turn of events. Mm. And I say this precisely because the ANC's rhetoric, as far as I can tell, has been consistent on the matter of race nationalism. And in fact, Jacob Zuma, of whom she was a great fan and defender for about a decade, really ramped it up. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it made a change, it made a change as she was rising up in the ANC. So I struggle to see some sort of increase in the temperature of race nationalism being responsible for Jesse Duarte suddenly coming out and saying, no, this is not cool. It seems more like, well, she's not on the cool side of it anymore, not because of the racial dynamics, but because of some personal issue with the patronage network that she then uses this as a way of garnering sympathy and maybe testing the waters for some political move as yet to be seen.
But for those of us who are sort of non-racialists, this really is a nice reminder of exactly one of the reasons why we oppose race nationalism, which is that it likes to draw circles smaller and smaller and smaller. And once again, we're sort of seeing that in that the definition of black seems to be decreasing every day.
Could this sound a bit bizarre, but she is... Part of the reason that she's feeling a bit isolated is that Ace Magashula, her boss, looks like not being the protector that he once was.
Yeah.
And that this will affect her, irrespective of which color she belongs to or not. And then maybe she's talking her way into a relationship with the good party.
Right. I really think it's worth considering things like that. And I think some of our listeners will be wondering to themselves, does this mean the Institute of Race Relations thinks that the ANC is now reforming itself to the point where Ace Magashule is nervous and Jesse Duarte is setting up a plan B in order to escape in case she gets sort of ousted or something like that? Well, I'm not sure that it strikes me as reform until the following point is made from the top. That making excuses for what's going on in your life on the basis of race is not going to be accepted. It's not going to be entertained unless you don't bring an allegation of racism. You bring hard evidence. You bring hard particular evidence. You don't have loose and vague stories. I mean, I think for people in the street when you're visiting campaigning and they say this is what happened to us, that's important and that's credible and that really should be taken seriously. I've had lots of conversations like that too. But when a politician wants to make any kind of accusation of racism, they need like a phone recording or an email or some quote. If they just wrote it down or they just remembered it, that's fine. But they need to have a particular person that they're accusing and they need to have hard evidence.
Yeah.
Then you've got a serious accusation of racism. Anything short of that is, in my opinion, destructive to this country, because what we've had is a lost decade, which started in 2003 when Jacob Zuma's hired hacks in the media, Ranjeni Munasami, accused Bulelani Ngoka, the then NPA, of being impimpi, of being an apartheid spy. It's hard to call a black dude racist, so you say, well, he's like works for white racists and used to spy on us. And, you know, by implication, we should put a tie around his neck and set him on fire.
And it's been a bit downhill since then.
It's been downhill because the idea was never snuffed out that you don't first bring an allegation and then hope that evidence is going to line up afterwards in your favor. First, you bring the evidence, and then we take it very seriously. And we must, you know, racism must not be tolerated, and you do what you can to hold it back. But I don't see reform in the ANC. At the moment, I see a continuation of the power plays by the same means, just with potentially new winners, and it distresses me. It does, of course, open the opportunity once again for the top leadership to stand up and say, "Guys, this is how we can do it better." I'm not holding my breath.
I think immediately it come back to the beginning of our discussion. It opens up the opportunity for the DA to really commit and be bold about committing and having the courage to do so, discarding BEE. Yeah.
And I think the time is right now. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. If you liked our show, please SMS your name to 32823. One of our agents will call you back and sign you up as a friend of the Institute. SMSs cost R1, and terms and conditions apply. Thank you very much for listening to The Daily Friend, and we'll catch you on the Wednesday edition.